most important yet maybe embarrassing jailbreaks. Six Palestinian prisoners escaping Israeli jail through a tunnel. Now, the Palestinian men who escaped the jail are seen as heroes, embarrassing for Israel, since they were able to escape a high-security Israeli jail, breaking the myth that Israeli prisons are inescapable. Meanwhile, Palestinians are holding them as heroes. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how this escape is emblematic of a major breakthrough in Israel's so-called invincibility, especially when it comes to its prisons, and how this will embolden other Palestinians to stand up to the Israeli regime.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jabal prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Let me introduce our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Charlotte Cates. She's an international coordinator at Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. We also have Mick Napier, activist for Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. And Charlotte Cates, let me first start with you. Looking at this Gilboa prison is the name, a high security facility that's located in northern Israel. And it's called the Safe. And yet you have the six Palestinian prisoners who escaped this prison. Does this constitute a rare humiliation for the Israeli security apparatus?
I think what this constitutes is an exposure of the lie that the technical advantage granted to the Israeli occupation by the unlimited financial and military support granted to it by the United States and other Western powers is actually an advantage that's able to stop Palestinian resistance. So certainly it's exposing the weakness and the rottenness at the core of the Israeli occupation over Palestine through the courage, steadfastness, and kind of humanity of Palestinian political prisoners. And so it shows that there is always hope for freedom and that oppressive systems are doomed to failure. So certainly, this is a moment of humiliation for the Israeli occupation. It's also a sign of just how steadfast, resistant, and committed Palestinians are to obtain their freedom despite all the most difficult circumstances.
So the two vantage points that we have, Mick Napier, and I'm wondering which one you agree with. One from Israel itself, who said that the prison service—that this is based on an Israeli prison service official, who said the escape was a major security and intelligence failure. And then from the Palestinian groups, you have them saying that this was a heroic act that took place. How do you see this, McNapier?
I think in any colonial situation, the colonizer invariably has a massive technological advantage, whether in methods of killing or in methods of repression. But what determines the outcome, whether it's Algeria or Vietnam or even Afghanistan, is not that technological overwhelming superiority. It's the determination of indigenous people to persist and to resist, to absorb the terrible punishment that is inflicted upon them, in every colonial situation, and still to resist. And you know, in a struggle for existence, which the Palestinians are engaged in, morale is absolutely critical. It's not even weapons, it's not anything other than morale. And Palestinian morale took a huge leap during the recent Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque and throwing Palestinian families onto the street in East Jerusalem and fascist gangs attacking Palestinians across 48 Israel. And the resistance that came from across the entire land surface of Palestine, the rockets from Gaza, the determination everywhere, forged a new sense of national unity and a readiness to resist. This is another. It's absolutely a disaster for the Israelis because they rely upon weapons that can kill to deter any opposition. And they also rely upon weapons of mass surveillance in order to crush the possibility of resistance. And you know, I think the Israeli salesmen who travel the world selling their grisly goods based on the fact that they've been tested on Palestinians and have been successful against Palestinians, their job in selling just became a little bit harder because armed with a rusty spoon, these six men got out of the safe. And now it's become a national struggle because the honor of protecting these men from Islamic Jihad and from Fatah, and I'm not sure if there was any from Hamas, but nonetheless, you know, the honor of protecting and defending these men from the Israeli dragnet means it's a national struggle. And we hope they can escape into Jordan or somewhere else, but even if they can't, Israel has already been dealt yet another blow. And you know, recently when one of the killers on the Gaza border, and you know, they had been killing literally hundreds of unarmed Palestinians. Recently, when a fighter from Gaza managed to kill the killer, the Israeli government went into a kind of crisis. This has deepened their crisis, and I think once again has raised the morale of the Palestinian people. They still have a terrible price to pay to win their freedom, but this means their call upon the international community is much, much louder.
Uh-huh. Well, Charlotte Cates, let's take a look at the six prisoners in terms of what charges were brought against them or not. And I say or not because we're looking at this policy that Israel has called administrative detention, where you have one definition says administrative detention is a preemptive measure that allows Israeli authorities to detain suspects before trial. Then you have the other definition of this in which it's basically stating that, let me bring this up, it's incarceration without trial or charge. alleging that a person plans to commit a future offense. And that is how many Palestinians actually get imprisoned, without committing something, but only suspicious that they may. Do you think that this process is legal?
No, I mean, administrative detention, which actually was introduced into occupied Palestine by the British colonial mandate and then was enthusiastically adopted by the Zionist regime, is routinely used by the Israeli occupation against Palestinians. There are currently approximately 4,650 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails, and of those, over 500 are held without charge or trial in administrative detention. And it's important to note that when we speak about administrative detention, these orders are issued for up to 6 months at a time. However, they are indefinitely renewable. And so Palestinians routinely are jailed for years at a time with no charge, with no trial, with not even their lawyers being allowed to see what kind of alleged evidence there is against them on the basis of a so-called secret file. And this is absolutely illegal under international law. Even the elements of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which purport to allow for some forms of detention by an occupying power, do not allow for the routine and systematic use of administrative detention, which is absolutely what Israel has always practiced when it comes to Palestinians. The people who are targeted for administrative detention are community leaders, are freedom fighters, are organizers, are people who are looked to by their communities, by their villages, by their refugee camps, by their cities, as people who mobilize and defend Palestinian rights. And this is the entire reason why they are subject to arbitrary detention without charge or trial, something that is in complete violation of international humanitarian law and international human rights law, and something which is, right now, there are six Palestinian prisoners who are on hunger strike, one of them for nearly 2 months, in order to obtain their freedom from administrative detention, because administrative detention is also an element of psychological torture and collective punishment as well, because not only are you detained unjustly, not only are you detained by a colonial occupier, but you never know when you are going to be released or if you will ever be released. And your family is in that same situation as you. Many times families have prepared a dinner to welcome their loved one home from administrative detention, only to be told that he's not coming out because another 6 month administrative detention order is going to be slapped on him now. And so we see people like Ghassan Zawahra, community leader in Dehesha refugee camp, Kitam Safin, the president of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, dozens of Palestinian university students. These are the people who are being held under administrative detention.
Well, Mick Napier, I'd also like to get your reaction on this because, as our guests there indicated, these detainments take anywhere from several months being in prison to several years, and perhaps even a lot more than that, without being charged, without telling them what they're being accused of. So give us your reaction to that. And I'm guessing that when this happens, well, what do you have? I mean, it's not like this happens once or twice a year. This is pretty much happening on a routine basis somewhat. You're getting a lot of Palestinians that keep accumulating in terms of their hate for the Israeli regime. They know that the Israeli regime is not liked, but when they get that experience, not only the one that's being imprisoned, but also their family members. So it kind of goes against establishing Israeli security with this act.
Charlotte's right about administrative detention. It's internment. It's snatching people from their homes and off the street without a semblance of a trial and jailing them indefinitely in six-month stages. But, you know, the entire system in Israel means, the so-called justice system, but it means that no Palestinian who's now incarcerated had, you know, received a trial in the sense that we would understand it. The system has a record of 99.7% conviction rate. For a Palestinian in this military system to be found not guilty is as rare as snow in summer. It doesn't happen. Let's say 100% conviction rate. That means that when a Palestinian goes in front of this court, his chances are zero. Her chances are zero. The only thing they can do is play the system and plead guilty in order to receive a reduced sentence. If they do not plead guilty, they'll have a sentence greatly increased. The court procedures will be dragged out for years and years. I'm sorry, I forget the guy's name, but Mohammed, who's a humanitarian aid worker with World Vision in Gaza, is currently at the end of his fifth year awaiting trial on trumped-up charges of fraud, of which he is completely innocent, but he's in prison because he refuses to sign a false confession. That would be his only route out. He has been told if he signs the false confession, he can go free for time served. So the system is processing Palestinians like pieces of meat. They are not treated as humans, not by the court system and not by the staff in the court system. It only takes a Shin Bet guy sitting beside a so-called military judge to lean over and mutter the word security, and there's nothing the Palestinian can do. So this is not every single Palestinian in Israeli jails is a political prisoner. None of them has received a trial in the sense that we would understand it. It's a system of mass kidnapping and internment of thousands of people at any particular moment. And you know, a high-powered Zionist group of lawyers went to look at the court system in the West Bank several years ago and reported back to say it was indefensible. It was a system to terrorize Palestinians and to crush Palestinians into submission. That's from Zionist lawyers in London. So the truth is indisputable. These men who managed to dig their way out of Gilboa prison, they're just like the people who dug their way out of World War II prisons under Nazi Germany and any other brutally repressive regime. But you know something? The reason they won, the reason they got out, is because of the contempt and the racism with which Palestinians are dealt in the Israeli system, both popular racism and state racism.
Uh-huh.
Every Israeli learns that Palestinians are stupid or ugly or dirty or something horrible, and therefore they're treated with contempt. Well, now that contempt has led to these guys being able to get out of the safe. It's a tremendous slap in the face for this brutal system of mass incarceration, mass killing, mass house demolition, and a system, by the way, which Amnesty International says is characterized by systematic torture. So yeah, it's wonderful to see this. This is a time for parties and giving out sweets to your friends.
Right, and Charlotte Cates, our guest there, mentioned in the beginning that this is truly a booster for the morale of Palestinians. So when you and it's evidence based on the way the Palestinians have cheered this in the Gaza Strip and even in the occupied West Bank, and with the resistance groups coming out and really hailing this as a victory of sorts, you wouldn't think that this may have had that kind of impact, but it has had that impact. And this morale increase, how could that translate into what Palestinians' goals are when it comes to the Israeli regime in terms of trying to break obviously occupation and the different violations that occur there?
Well, this route through the Freedom Tunnel is in many ways a path to liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. The Palestinian prisoners are so central to the Palestinian cause because they represent the resistance. They represent a true and uncompromised leadership of the Palestinian people, and they represent a real symbol of national unity that means more than just kind of discussions about governance or the Palestinian Authority, but instead are about the national unity that is obtained in fighting the occupation and resisting until victory. And so just as we talked about earlier, this shows that the technological superiority of the Israeli occupation can fall in the face of a determined indigenous resistance. And you know, this is what we've seen when the resistance on the ground has prevented the Israeli occupation from entering Gaza. This is certainly what we saw in Lebanon, when the resistance of the people drove out the occupation and forced it to leave. That despite that, you know, $3.8 billion of weaponry given to Israel every year by the most powerful army in the world, the United States, that does not stop the people of Palestine, just as it did not stop the people of Lebanon from liberating themselves. And so these six Palestinian prisoners are symbols of hope. They are symbols of the fact that liberation is not an idle dream, that liberation is possible, that it can be obtained, and that it can be obtained through planning, through strategy, through resistance, and through organizing themselves. And that's also the message that the Palestinian prisoners movement reflects as a whole. Right now, inside the prisons, there is an uprising going on. There are cells being burned in response to attacks by Israeli occupation forces. There are people taking to the streets throughout Palestine in support of these prisoners. So it's a moment of celebration, but it's also a moment of knowing that the struggle can be built and that victory can be achieved. And so it's also a symbol for everyone around the world who is looking for liberation, who is looking for justice, who is looking for freedom. These six men are representatives of the hope and the dreams of humanity in many ways. And so their continued freedom, the defense of them, and the mass embrace of the Palestinian people for not just these six Palestinian prisoners, but all of the nearly 5,000 held behind Israeli bars, reflects the fact that liberation is not only possible, but is in fact inevitable. But it can't come without all of us working, organizing, building the boycott of Israel, isolating the Israeli occupation regime, and building support and solidarity with the Palestinian people and their resistance.
Okay, final question to you. Going along the lines of what Charlotte Cates has said is obviously not something Israel wants to happen. So let's talk about the Israeli reaction here, what they're going to do. McNabb here, as she mentioned, you got the Palestinian prisoners inside jails setting it on fire. Obviously, Israel doesn't want that. I'm guessing they're going to go out trying to crush this one way or another. It is said that their entrance into the Jenin refugee camp to look for the prisoners is imminent. There's going to be resistance there. Looking down further down the road, then are we looking at something happening between Palestinians and Israel because of this incident? How do you see it?
Well, Bennett, the Prime Minister, is an Arab killer. He said, I've killed lots of Arabs. I don't have a problem with that. The Israelis will be looking for people to kill because they have to restore what they call their deterrent edge and also to repress. So, yes, the Israeli response will be bloody and violent. But this resistance will inspire people around the world. Solidarity is only possible if people resist. The more they resist, the more the solidarity can be delivered. And this is an inspiration. We will now go forward to build a campaign, to intensify the campaign to boycott and isolate the state of Israel, because the Palestinians have shown that even if the Abu Dhabi and Riyadh, Israeli team, Cairo, obviously Britain and America aligning with the Israeli regime, nonetheless, the Palestinian resistance has not been broken, even although it's possibly the most unequal situation of any anti-colonial struggle in history. They show that they can win. It's a symbol, and it will lead to victory.
Thank you. Thank you. Unfortunately, going to have to end it, McNabb, here. Activist Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Charlotte Cates, thank you. International Coordinator of the Samidon Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network from Vancouver. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitahwe, it's goodbye. Until next time.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Last Savior. I have the honor of being joined by our expert, Dr. Murtaza Karimi. Thank you so very much for being with us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, sir, for your time. Today, and as always, on The Last Savior, we'll be discussing topics concerning doubts and misconceptions on Mahdawiya, which I think really is a topic that isn't talked about enough. So apparently, one of the doubts, misconceptions, misinterpretations, or questions, whatever it is that you want to call it, that's posed against the concept of Mahdawiyya is a claim that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam themselves denied the existence of a child for Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. If such a claim is true, then that would naturally create a lot of division and misguidance and misunderstandings for the Ummah and for the future generations to follow. So how exactly do we clear out this doubt? How do we answer this problem?
There is a story mentioned in Tariq al-Tabari, and some of the Wahhabi scholars, they have resorted to this story to claim that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam themselves, they denied any child for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. When the Ahlul Bayt themselves didn't believe in a child for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, there is no room for the Shia to claim that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is son of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. Let me read what one of these Wahhabi scholars has mentioned in his books. He says that in Tariq al-Tabari, when he narrates the stories of the year 302 after Hijra, so it's important the date, is 302 after Hijra. He mentions that at the time of Muqtadir, the Abbasid Caliph, a person claimed that I am Muhammad son of Hassan, that is, I am the son of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. And the Caliph commanded all the nobles from Banu Hashim to be invited and to be called to the court, and among them was a person called Ahmad ibn Abd al-Samad, known as Ibn Tumar, and he was the Naqib of Talibin. Naqib literally means somehow leader, and for each time we have some Nuqaba, some leaders for the Shia. One of their duties was to somehow register the names of Banu Hashim, to know, for example, the members of the people who belong to this clan, Banu Hashim. So Ibn Tumar was, he was invited to the court, and in front of the Caliph and some of the Shia, he mentions that Hassan did not have any child. This Wahhabi scholar narrates the story this way. Ibn Tumar said Hassan didn't have any child. Then Banu Hashim cried out because of the claim of this person, and then they told the Caliph that this person should be punished and should be tortured. So he was tied on a camel, and it was, he was dragged off. Yeah, and taken among the people. So, and later he was imprisoned. So the conclusion of this Wahhabi scholar is that, as you see here in this story, first of all, the Naqib of Talibiyin, that is the leader of them, Ibn Tumar, he mentions explicitly that Hassan, that is Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, does not have any child. And right after him, Banu Hashim cry out that this man should be punished because he has brought about a false claim. It means that they also agreed that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam did not have any child.
I don't understand. They say that he should be punished for saying Imam al-Hassan did not have children. How does that mean they agreed with him?
That's the point. What you mentioned is very good, because this
that's the paradox of it.
Yeah, that's part of the answer. The way that this Wahhabi scholar narrates the story is that Banu Hashim cried out that why this person has claimed that I am the son of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, because Imam al-Askari alayhi salam did not have any child. But when you read the complete version of the story, we come to another conclusion that they mentioned that we know Imam al-Askari alayhi salam has a child, he's Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and he's just telling a lie. So this is the way that this Wahhabi scholar has mentioned the story. Now the first answer is that, first of all, he is narrating from a Sunni source, that is Tariq al-Tabari. So for us, the Shia, it cannot prove anything. It's not necessary for us to answer all the stories mentioned in non-Shia books. But anyway, the main point is that let's assume that the story is true, but as I mentioned, this Wahhabi scholar did not mention the story in its complete form. So, as I mentioned, the way he narrates the story is that Ibn Tumar, the Naqib of Talibiyin, he mentions that Imam al-Askari al-Salam does not have any child, and Banu Hashim, they cry out, meaning that they also believed in the same, that Imam al-Askari al-Salam do not have any child. And he mentions that Wahad al-Shahada min Bani Hashim wa ala rasihim al-Naqib al-Talibiyin Muhammad. This is very important, that Banu Hashim and before them, their Naqib, their leader, all of them, they witnessed that Imam al-Askari al-Salam do not have any child.
Brothers and sisters, you're listening to The Last Savior here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short message, so stay with us.
We wanted to confer favor upon those who were oppressed in the land and make them leaders and make them inheritors.
Welcome back to IRB English Radio. You're listening to The Last Savior. In the studio with me, I have Dr. Murtaza Karimi, and we are discussing doubts and misconceptions regarding the topic of Mahdawiyya.
Let me narrate the story in its complete form. I skipped some of the details. Muqtadir, according to this story as mentioned by Tariq al-Tabari, he invites Ibn Tumar and some of the people from the Shia and the Ahlul Bayt to listen to the claims of this person. Ibn Tumar asked about his lineage. He said that I'm Muhammad son of Hassan son of Ali. Then Ibn Tumar said the following. He said Hassan did not have any child, but some people believe that he left a child. So he mentions the both, but this Wahhabi scholar only mentioned the first part of his sentence. I will come to explain why Ibn Tumar has talked in this manner. So Ibn Tumar says, some people believe that Imam al-Hassan did not have any child, and some people believe that he had a child. Ibn Tumar said, this man claims that he has come from a desert, but he has a new brand sword. Let's take his sword to the bazaar to see who has sold him this sword. According to the story, they took the sword to the bazaar and they knew who was the seller of the sword, and the man was taken to the court. And he was asked, who did you sell the sword to? And he said that a man known as Ibn Dab'i, whose father is from the companions of Ibn Furat. Then Dab'i was invited by the caliph, and he claimed that that person, that claimant, is my son. So the seller of the sword told the people that the one who bought it from me was the son of Dab'i. Dab'i was brought, and he said that this person is son of me, not son of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. So the claimant was embarrassed, and then they began to cry before the caliph, and then Banu Hashim cried out. After seeing that this person has told all these lies, and then they told the caliph that this person should be punished. So you see, this part of the story has been omitted by this Wahhabi scholar to come to a wrong conclusion. He mentions that Ibn Tumar said, "Lam yu'aqib al-Hasan wa qad dajja banu Hashim min da'wa hadha ar-rajul." Ibn Tumar said Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam did not have any child, and Banu Hashim cried out because of the claim of this person. But the point is that, first of all, Ibn Tumar says, some people believe that Hassan did not have any child, and some people believe that he had a child. The reason that Banu Hashim cried out was the lie of this person.
Right.
And the fact that he was, I mean, his reality was known to the people, to the caliph, and it was explicitly proved that he is son of a person called Dab'i and not Imam al-Askari alayhi salam.
So basically the whole thing was taken out of context.
Exactly.
And what this Wahhabi scholar did was that he took bits and pieces of a story and tried to stitch them together to support his own theory.
That's the point.
a question just in case it might cross the minds of the listener as it did mine. This Ibn Tulmud character, is he a reliable figure, whether in Sunni or Shi'i sources?
I didn't find this name in Shia sources, so I'm not sure about he's a trustworthy person or not. But then another question might rise that if he is the leader of Banu Hashim, why in front of Al-Muqtadir he says that some people believe in Imam al-Askari alayhi salam having a child and some people do not believe in that? At the end of the day, if he is the leader of Banu Hashim, he should say for sure Imam al-Askari alayhi salam left a child, and that is Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam that we believe in. And this is a very important question. But first of all, let's assume that this is a true story. Let's assume that this is a trustworthy person and he is the leader of the Shia. I go back to the age. As I mentioned, the age is very important. It is, as mentioned by Tabari, it is 302 after Hijra. Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born in 255. His father was martyred in 260. The minor occultation began from 260 to 329. So 32 is in the minor occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. And we know that before the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam and after his birth and during the time of the minor occultation, the Abbasid rulers of the time were searching for Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam to kill him, because they had heard about the narrations of his birth and the fact that he will fill the earth with justice. Before his birth, from time to time, the agents of the caliph used to come into the house of Imam Askari alayhi salam and search, among the ladies to see if any of them is pregnant or not. And that is why the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was in a miraculous way. So this incident happened, if it is true, in 302 after Hijra. And the caliph of the time, the Abbasid caliphate, they are searching for Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam to kill him. So it's very natural and logical for this person, Ibn Tulmud, not to mention the name of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and not to mention explicitly that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam has had a child. Somehow he's doing what we call it tawriya. He doesn't tell a lie that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam did not have a child. He says some people believe that Hassan al-Askari had a child and some people deny that. And he's true, because some people denied his birth, at least for some maybe days or some weeks. Even we had among the Shia some people to deny that, because the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam was miraculous. Many people did not know about that. The reason Ibn Tulmud is doing that, it is because of the fact that they were, and not only him, all the Shia were commanded by the Imams, especially Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, not even to mention the name of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. We know that we have in some narrations that do not name Muhammad. Instead, we see in some of the books it is written separately, the letters Mim Ha Mim Dal. The reason was that they didn't want the caliphs of the time to know even about the name of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So if Ibn Tulmud is doing that, he's exactly obeying the commands of the Imams. And not only him, all the Shia used to do that, not to mention explicitly that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam had a child, and not to mention his name, his place, and other attributes of him.
Thank you so very much, Doctor, for your mind-opening explanations. And thank you so very much to our listeners for being with us once more on today's episode of The Last Savior. Until another greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The World with Reporters.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang, and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example, are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
The European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jalbo prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, the describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Voices of dissent outside Europe's biggest weapons fair, euphemistically called Defense and Security Equipment International, DSEI. More than 37,000 delegates descending on the British capital this year for a close encounter of the military kind, with more than 1,700 companies and dozens of governments here to buy or sell. Some are offering surveillance equipment, other manufacturers marketing all manner of lethal hardware, among them those who profited immensely from the so-called war on terror. The UK claims that it's leading the way in ethical arms sales.
We have a procedure that follows the consolidated criteria that is very clear around humanitarian law. We have in place a rigorous and robust process.
That is a claim dismissed by groups such as Stop the Arms Fair. They say by hosting the weapons show, Britain is perpetuating conflict and putting profit before human lives.
This arms fair wouldn't happen without the UK's support, the government's support. The defence and security exports team of the government makes sure that this arms fair happens. They know that human rights abusing countries are coming here to buy weapons that are made by UK companies and also foreign companies that we host in our country.
Campaigners also point out that several countries specifically invited here, such as the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, are on the UK government's human rights watch list.
The fact that we're hosting such hideous weaponry and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
In recent years, short of 60% of British arms exports have gone to the Middle East, accounting for billions of dollars in sales. Most of that business has gone to Saudi Arabia, which, according to many rights groups, has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes in Yemen. Since 2015, the UK government has approved hundreds of arms export licenses to Saudi Arabia, worth more than $9 billion. Of that figure, nearly $2 billion came between July and September last year, after a court here rejected a legal challenge to ban weapon sales to the kingdom, a move slammed by critics as immoral. The UK also sells record amounts of arms to Israel, lending support to Tel Aviv's militarized repression of Palestinians. Campaigners in Britain's political opposition are calling for an immediate change in government policy. But while they point out a shift in public opinion in recent years, the arms fair and the multi-billion dollar worldwide industry that drives it shows every sign of growing. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The Taliban spokesman has declared the collapse of Panjshir Valley in the north of Kabul. Zabihullah Mujahid says the war is over in Afghanistan and that there is no anti-Taliban resistance in the country, except by Daesh.
The war is ended all over Afghanistan after successfully capturing Panjshir province as the last stronghold for the ousted enemy. The Islamic Emirate forces have active presence in the valley.
However, the leader of National Resistance Front says he is in Panjshir and that his forces are deployed across the strategic areas of the valley. According to Massoud, the resistance will push ahead with its fight on the Taliban until victory is achieved. In an audio message, Massoud called on all Afghans to come together and stand against the Taliban.
I call on all my countrymen inside and abroad to launch a national uprising to defend our dignity, independence, and freedom. I also call on the international community to be aware that the Taliban has never changed.
The leader of National Resistance Front also slammed the Taliban for what he called defying the demand of a top delegation of religious scholars to engage in talks to resolve the conflict in Panjshir. He also accused Pakistan of directly invading Afghanistan, saying the Pakistani military used drones to bomb Panjshir to help the Taliban.
Ahmed Massoud's claim on the Pakistani military interference in Panjshir has complicated the situation.
On Monday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman was asked about the reports of Pakistani airstrikes. The spokesman said Iran condemns all foreign interference in Afghanistan without specifying any country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A two-day meeting of G20 health ministers wrapped up in the Italian capital on Monday, ensuring sustainable development in a post-pandemic world and preventing future pandemics were among the issues discussed by the group. At the end of the meeting, Roberto Speranza, the health minister of Italy, which holds the G20 presidency this year, announced the unanimous adoption of the Pact of Rome and the pledge that the group of 20 will make sure the world's population has access to COVID-19 vaccines.
Ma dobbiamo necessariamente rendere altre aree del...
We want to build the conditions to make it possible to take the COVID-19 vaccines to the most fragile countries. Furthermore, with the Pact of Rome, it was decided to make a commitment to reinforce the health systems.
Now that public health and social measures have been relaxed in many countries, COVID vaccination rates have slumped in some parts of the world, and authorities are worried. G20 health ministers have stressed that the public's vaccination is crucial.
The G20 talks have taken place against the backdrop of a flaming debate over the so-called Green Pass, a mandatory proof of anti-COVID vaccination. The Italian government is considering extending its Green Pass to all employees in the public sector, but part of the ruling coalition is against it.
The Italian government has already made the Green Pass mandatory for school staff and for passengers on long-distance public transport. This has prompted a swath of protests across Italy over the past months. About 37.5 million Italians, out of a population of less than 60 million, have received both COVID vaccine doses so far. Italian authorities aim at vaccinating 80% of the population by the end of September, a target that seems unlikely to be met. Max Civili, Rome.
The EU Rule of Law Report 2021 singles out Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, Croatia and Slovenia for particular criticism. It reaches conclusions but provides zero recommendations.
It's toothless and spineless because what we have is a carefully worded partial account of threats to the rule of law without any joining of the dots, without any calling things out as they are.
The European Commission's Rule of Law report was published in July. This is the first opportunity members of the European Parliament, MEPs, have had to debate it. Some governments in the EU are accused of corruption, stifling media freedom, and interfering in judicial systems.
Such as Austria, for example, where public prosecutors responsible for high-profile corruption cases have been confronted with negative portrayals by government representatives.
Calls have been made for EU funding to be withheld.
No money from the recovery plan can be used by these oligarchs to further capture the state and further organize elections in their favor. We should be very, very serious about that.
Far-right EU lawmakers were criticized during the debate.
You protect a Hungarian autocrat who gives money to everywhere there in dark channels in corruption.
Legislators say EU governments are failing to ensure human rights and promote religious tolerance. It's a particular issue for Jews and Muslims.
For me, Muslims are two times victims. One, as a citizen like you and me, but secondly, because their religion is hijacked by extremists who make a horrible thing of it.
The European Commission has powers to enforce rule of law, but is accused of not using them.
It is a problem for all of us. It's a problem because this spreads. And also, it's a problem when the Commission doesn't manage to act properly.
Some MEPs are asking the question, why is it EU leaders are so quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations for alleged rule of law breaches, but turn a blind eye when one of their own nations steps out of line? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanon is in a day of national mourning after the passing of head of the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council in Lebanon at the age of 85.
Sheikh Abdel Amir Qabalan was viewed by those who knew him as not only a religious figure, but a national figure who strove for the best interest of the country.
Lebanon's problem doesn't lie in its religious or sectarian diversity, but in some corrupt officials who hide behind their sects and call on their followers to move away from their genuine belief. Sheikh Qabalan, along with other clerics, exerted all efforts to keep the sectarian diversity as national treasure. Lebanon cannot be a transit area for the Zionists or the U.S. It should be a symbol of resistance and national pride, as he wanted.
The deceased cleric was known for his moderation and therefore his impact on mediating talks between Lebanese political groups.
The demise of Sheikh Qabalan comes at a critical time for Lebanon, which is unprecedented in Lebanon's history. Lebanon needs such figures at this stage. He was someone open to all sides in Lebanon, whether political or religious. He had always called for solving our internal crisis peacefully. Also, he was a supporter of the resistance.
In a statement, the Speaker of the Parliament, Nabih Birri, stressed that Ayatollah Qabalan followed in the footsteps of Imam Musa Sadr in moderation, coexistence, and resisting deprivation and occupation.
Ayatollah
Sheikh Qabalan's demise is a great loss for Lebanon and the Muslim world. We all know he was among the close companions of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, and together they worked for the poor and the oppressed. They established the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council, which serves as a center for congregation and dialogue for all Lebanese. We pray that this sad occasion could push the Lebanese officials to put differences aside and quickly form a cabinet, since Lebanon is in dire need for an active government.
Caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab declared Tuesday the day of the funeral procession for the spiritual leader as a national holiday. Throughout his life, Sheikh Qabalan called on everyone to preserve the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine. He also preached unity among the Lebanese and Muslims, a move which made him a mediator on many occasions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As the world battles extraordinary refugee crisis for decades, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India after the Taliban take over of their country, they have been protesting outside the UN refugee office in New Delhi, demanding refugee status, justice, and protection for their women and children. Experts say India is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention or the 1967 protocols relating to the status of refugees. Therefore, it would be a challenging task to deal with another refugee influx. In India, where internal migration has been one of the most challenging tasks for the country due to huge population and possible mismanagement of the refugee policies. Observers say another refugee exodus could be a hard job for the country, considering its complex bureaucratic registration process. They say the country needs a uniform refugee policy. As India has no specific program for refugees, it allows the UNHCR to operate a program for them. Based on reports, thousands of Afghans are registered with the UN Refugee Agency, but there are many who are still demanding the refugee status despite arriving in India a decade ago. Experts say now the new influx might compel India to rethink its refugee policy.
Like many other nations and countries, India is home to a large group of and large chunk of refugees who come from their countries of origin to seek protection. But the confusion arises when we come to the mechanism, how India governs its refugees. In India, they have not a sound mechanism which can deal and which can protect these minorities.
A decade ago, scores of Afghan refugees arrived in India, leaving their war-torn country. But they still have trouble in accessing basic services like education, healthcare, and employment. Many are now demanding financial assistance due to lack of income. Others say they would return to their country, but are skeptical and still reeling from the violent past.
I think we have no future as the whole world is silent on our plight. The memories of violence still haunts us. I have a refugee card, but it does not help me as it should as a refugee. I urge the UN and the international community to pay urgent attention to us. We are worried for our future as our fate remains uncertain.
Despite India's rich history of ties with Afghanistan and home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from across the globe, the country has no clear-cut policy for refugees or any domestic law. Experts say by framing a concrete refugee law, India would be able to appropriately protect the rights of refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Talks over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal have faced a three-month hiatus following Iranian elections in June that brought Ebrahim Raisi to power. The European parties to the multilateral accord are now urging Iran to come back to negotiations. The new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi,